one into the night, deep into right, way out of here.
Swung on,
did it,
crushed, and the Phillies are going to lead it.
Harper, the swing of his life.
The 0-2 pitch, swing and a miss, struck him out.
From WHYY, it is hitting season. Hey there, podcast pals. I'm John Stolness from The Good Fight. You can follow me on X and Blue Sky at John Stolness. Coming up, Phillies split their four-game series against the Atlanta Braves in a game that sure felt like it had playoff implications and an atmosphere at Citizens Bank Park like we're going to see coming up in the next month or so. And did we learn anything new about the Phillies, or felt to me like we just confirmed a lot of stuff we already knew about them and we have seen in past October? So we're going to break it all down to some big takeaways from this four-game series, as these two teams sit exactly where they were before it started. The Phillies holding the first wild card spot, this time by a half a game over the Cubs and four games back of the same Atlanta Braves in the National League East. So joining me here on this roundtable to talk all about this important four-game series in which a lot of stuff happened, Justin Clue and Liz Rocher. Liz Rocher, of course, is the editor of Sabres Baseball Research Journal. You can follow her on X and Blue Sky at Liz Rocher. Liz, hello. Big series, and people were in the fields this weekend. A lot going on.
It was a big series. I got to watch most of it, actually, I think all of it, with my family, which is something we don't get to do just outside of a handful of times a year. So it was really great. We didn't get to watch today's game together, but I've got lots of texts from my dad and my sister being very excited about it. I'm like, yes, yes, I am too. This was a needles and pins kind of game, but it ended perfectly. Today is Monday.
And Monday's game was a blink and you missed it. An hour and 51 minutes on Sunday, the fastest game in baseball this year. And it was the Phillies' fastest nine-inning game since the 4th of July, 1989 at Veterans Stadium. And that game went an hour and 44 minutes. It's the shortest Phillies game since a 99-minute game in August of 2022. Only two Phillies games of an hour and 51 or under since 2006. So yeah, this was a Lightning McQueen game here on Monday against the Braves to finish things off. The Phillies 1-0 win that was a certainly very exciting finish. Justin Clue from Baseball Prospectus also hosts a couple of Patreon podcasts for us, the Dirty Inning and Absolutely Hammered. You can follow him on Blue Sky at Justin Clue, and of course, if you haven't gotten his book Summer of the Cheap Wieners, summer's almost over. Labor Day is come and gone. I mean, it's technically still summer, but you've wasted a whole summer without it. But there's still time. There's still time. Justin, how you doing, bud?
My nephew has been to two Phillies games in the past year, and one was the one where they like homered a ton and scored a ton, and they won with like no doubt. And then he was at the game on August 17th when they went back and forth with the Marlins from the sixth inning on, and then they won this really tight, exciting game. And then today, to your point about how quickly the game was moving, my friend brought his baby child to a game for the first time, got the little certificate, like, this is my first Phillies game. And then he said part of the reason I think he held it together and was able to, you know, to enjoy it was that the game was like a tight 80 minutes and just cruised by and didn't really test anybody's limits. So good job, Phillies. Way to grow the game. I will say, Phillies, like adult to adult here, when you present this way to children, I do feel like it's almost like introducing them to street drugs, in that you are saying, like, this is the experience that you will have at Phillies games. And, well, I mean, I think we all know the truth, the truth hidden behind that statement. So, you know, it's a dangerous game you're playing, but what do you know? Two more fans for life. Way to go, Phillies.
It's a dark drug. And you know, it looks pleasant and wonderful at first, you know, and they hand out certificates.
I mean, look how happy we sound on this show every week. That's what these kids have in store for them for the rest of their lives.
That's right. Congratulations, kids. And I hope that they do become steadfast hitting season listeners so that they can take part in the many ups and a few downs that we experience here as Phillies fans. To everybody who's going to take a child, that you don't get a certificate to every time you go out. It's just a one-time deal. What do you guys think about super short games? Like, you pay money to go to a game. I mean, if you've got little kids, it's brilliant. It's amazing. You take a little kid to a game, it's great. But for everybody else, like, I don't know. I'd feel kind of cheated with an hour and 51 minutes. And there's nothing they could do about it. I mean, that's why they got, you know, everything else there. You could hang out and do other stuff, I guess. But I don't know. That's a tight game. I'd feel a little gypped if I were a paying customer on an hour and 51 minute day.
This is the conversation we had around the pitch clocks when they started happening. It was like, yeah, I mean, this is like a net good. Obviously, they're cutting some of the fat out of baseball, which, you know, even purists were able to see in retrospect. OK, this is kind of a good thing that Manfred did. But I remember saying, like, it was a nice feeling knowing I was leaving one place since the second inning. And it's probably gonna be like the fourth inning by the time I get home. Now, that game's much closer to being over by the time you get home. And as far as like being there in the stadium, you're definitely, I think, less conscious of like the passage of time.
Yeah.
At least like looking at the clock, partially because, you know, they got rid of that stupid clock nobody looked at anymore anyway from Connie Mack. And the like streamlined kind of nature of baseball feels fresher and cooler. And you're just like, oh, we're seeing like a great game. I think in general, a pitcher's duel is more enjoyable in the ballpark than being watched on television. And that's typically the kind of game you're talking about. So, yeah, I mean, it depends, but I see your argument, but you also just got to be able to curate your own game day experience. You know, if you want to show up 3 hours ahead of the game, it's not going to matter that it was 80 minutes long, but you were playing cornhole before the game started and like having beers with your friends in the parking lot. So it's all about how you address game day, essentially.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Liz, you feel the same way? Are you happy about, like, do you feel a little cheated if it's too short?
No, I don't feel cheated. I mean, I'm going to a baseball game to watch baseball, not to watch them faff around in the box or on the mound and just doing their stupid crap. Like, I'm not paying to see
that. I could stand for some more faffing.
I'd like to see more faffing in baseball. I mean, honestly, I was a paying customer to a very short game. I think it was 2010. I watched Jamie Moyer throw a 2-hour and 2-minute complete game. I don't think it was a shutout. Maybe it was. It was like 7-0, maybe. But it was a quick game. And as we were leaving, we said, well, that was really quick. But it was really fun. And so, like, we didn't care. I would have loved to see today's game and paid money for it because I would have gotten to see Jesus Luzardo throw a complete game shutout for the first time in his career. Like, if a game is quick, it's not usually because people are bad. It's because one side's real good at doing something. And today, neither side was that good at hitting, but it was great pitching.
Yeah. Well,
there's times when the Phillies take the lead and I'm ready for the game to be over instantaneously.
Pretty much then and there. Yeah.
Yes.
Right then and there. Even if it's 45 minutes. Let's just call it a day. Let's just call it. It's what they should have done on Sunday. As this series had quite a number of ups and downs. A very quick recap for everybody. We'll work backwards. Monday, of course, Phillies win 1-0. It was their 17th shutout of the season. And really, two guys. Kyle Schwarber with an 8th inning boom shot off the facing of the second deck in right field for the only run of the game, two outs in the 8th inning. He hits that home run. And then Jesus Luzardo finishes off his first ever complete game shutout. We're going to get into the details of that more coming up in just a second. On Sunday, I thought this was the toughest game of the year. This is the first game this year that I actually felt a strong emotion, a really strong negative emotion, like anger and frustration and a little burning sensation in my chest. Now, that could have been the tacos, but I really feel it was the Phillies game. They blew a 4-1 lead in the 8th inning after Derek Hill hit a pinch hit homer and Kyle Schwarber went deep. Aaron Nola had just thrown 7 beautiful innings, and then you had Ronald Acuna hit the 3-run home run off of Alex McFarland. Duran gives up a double and a triple in the 9th, and we had to just deal with Acuna for that entire game on Sunday. Saturday night was a whole lot of fun. Phillies saw Zach Wheeler return to dominance. That was great. They got 3 big innings from the bullpen. Kyle Schwarber homered and reached base 4 times. So homers in 3 straight games from Kyle Schwarber to finish off to this series. And then Friday night, you had Chris Sale out-dueling Christopher Sanchez in another good game, but some late-inning bullpen work by Ryan Kirkering turned a 1-run deficit into a 3-run deficit, and that was it. So a lot of ups and downs here in this series, guys. And like I said, they finish it where they started, four games behind the Braves in the National League East, but the Braves kind of did what they wanted to do. They just kind of kept the Phillies at arm's length, knocked 4 games off the schedule, lowered their magic number by, I think, it probably about 2 games or something like that. like that, or by two, whatever the number is. No, by four. They did it by four because it counts Braves wins and Phillies losses at the same time. So all in all, Liz, give me a big takeaway from this series for you. Like, before we get into like the nitty gritty of it, I'm going to ask you both to just kind of give me a big takeaway, an overarching feeling that you have. What do you take away from this series against the Braves here at Citizens Bank Park?
I felt my takeaway was that the Phillies are competitive, which sounds like a really obvious thing to say, but it was nice to see them matching up with, you know, one of the best teams in baseball right now. You know, they split the series and we wish for a better outcome, but they didn't lose the series. And to me, that's a win, or at least a general positive. It was nice to see them really, you know, excited and taking it to the Braves. Like, I think we, Justin and I, talked on Friday about how much the Braves and Phillies may or may not hate each other. But that stupid thing that the Braves do when they're running the bases with the arms and the flapping makes me want to scream. I hate it, and I hate them, and I wanted to see the Phillies punch their faces in. What are you going to say, Justin?
You can't let it. You can't admit that it's getting to you. That's the problem. That's Wheeler stepped in it by being like, "Nah, don't do that." That's exactly what he wants, and he did it, and then he beat him again.
I can be this way. The players can't be, but I, as a fan, am allowed to say I'm really sick of that, and I hate them. I feel a deep burning fire. Flames at the side of my face. It's really just, I hate them. And so seeing them being able to at least split the series with a team that they want to beat and will probably have to beat at some point if they want to make it far into the playoffs, it felt pretty good. You know, they weren't overmatched overall. I think they looked bad in parts of games for sure. Maybe large parts of some games, but the end result's what matters. And I feel like in this series, the end result bore out that the Phillies are doing okay. They're doing great. They're competitive and they could take it to whatever team they need to down the line.
Nice Madeline Kahn Clue reference there, by the way, Liz.
Thank you.
Love that. All time great.
Genuinely one of my favorite movies of all time.
100% agree. Strong agree. And certainly worth a rewatch with the passing of Tim Curry recently. Oh. But yeah, great line. Great line in that movie. All right, Justin, big takeaway from you. I know there's a lot we could have, but like any feeling that you're left with following this series against the Braves, if you're a Phillies fan right now, which you are.
No, it's just this really nice thing about a series like this is that it was able to project like the inside of every fan's watching's head on the side of the wall. It was just every fantasy, every worst nightmare you can imagine about this team experiencing in October, you got to see it happen. And therefore, everyone gets to say they have recent proof of why this team will or will not succeed in the playoffs. Are you worried about the Phillies' offense in the postseason? Well, here's a 1-0 victory written by the starting pitchers. If you're feeling confident, well, here's a 7 wasted one-run innings from Aaron Nola and a loss given up by your bulletproof closer. Are you worried about mojo? Well, Zach Wheeler got through 6 with some early offense, so, you know, that's great. Flying too high? Ding dong! Who's there? It's Ronald Acuña Jr., and he just ruined your day, and now he's jogging very slowly around your house. So, any way you want to take it, you know, this series kind of provided evidence for everybody for how they feel like this is going to go. I think we're on record now saying, like, this is not a projectable situation for the Phillies anymore. They go into the postseason how they go into the postseason, and then they do what they're going to do. We know what this team's capable of and what their strengths are and what their weaknesses are. They were all on display, I think, over these 4 games against the Braves. And the fact, you know, there's an argument to be made that it was only a split was good news. There's also an argument to be made that, boy, they got such great starting pitching. They really should have won more than 2 games in this series. You're not wrong and to make either argument. So I think whatever you want evidence for, this series really provided it.
Yeah, and that's my big takeaway kind of as well. Is like this series just backed up every thought you have about the Phillies, both good and both bad. All of the strengths that we knew that this Phillies team has and we've seen in past Octobers, namely the starting pitching, really, was on full display. And all of the things that have tripped them up in the playoffs, an inconsistent offense, an inability to hit with runners in scoring position, strikeouts in big moments, lack of production against good starting pitching, which I get, most people don't hit good starting pitching, but in the playoffs, it's all you're going to see mostly. So you got to do it to some degree. And bullpen blowups in this. Thank goodness Jesus Luzardo went the full nine. I wasn't ready to see anybody come in from the bullpen trying to protect a one-run lead this time. And so I thought we were getting a sneak preview of Phillies baseball this weekend. And again, it's a coin flip with this team in October. They had great starting pitching, undisciplined at bats, struggles with runners in scoring position, some bad luck, occasional home runs by the big guys, and late blown leads. Like it all piles up to just kind of like, you know, what's going to happen today? Like there's just, it's, I'm not saying this negatively necessarily. The Phillies can win the World Series playing this way. There's no doubt about it. When you pitch this well from your starters, you can win the World Series this way. And to kind of back up my point, go ahead.
No, I'm curious if you're going to make the same point I'm going to make. Go ahead.
Well, I'm just going to say there was a tweet that SportsCenter put out from ESPN SportsCenter that Buster Olney was apparently on SportsCenter. And he said, teams are scared to death about playing the Phillies in a postseason series because they would have to face Wheeler and Sanchez and, yes, Jesus Luzardo. And I've got some numbers from them in this series. A combined ERA by the four Phillies starters of 1.61 in this series, 31 strikeouts, 7 walks. I think the Phillies are going to enter the postseason with the best trio of starting pitchers in baseball. And I don't know that it's enough. You know, we've seen they've kind of done this in years past. So I guess my big takeaway from this weekend and from this series is, yes, the starting pitching is as dominant, if not the most dominant starting pitching in Major League Baseball. But as we've all seen, If that's your biggest strength and that's all you really have, then it's tough. It's not a guarantee of anything. It's actually it's very difficult to win a World Series, to win playoff series, if it's just your starting pitching that's dominant and everything else is kind of up in the air.
Okay, so you're not wrong, obviously. It's not enough, but it can be enough. You know, all of those caveats are all in place. The real thing you got to be able to do is present, you know, examples for people to grab onto and grounds these kind of like broader concepts of like, it might, but it could be, and it shouldn't have to be, and blah, blah, blah. And like, yeah, sure. So let's go ahead and just cite an example of a time when a team kind of had really strong starting pitching and used that to win a World Series. We know that it's possible because we've seen it happen. We've watched in horror as it's happened. And I hate to say it, but the 2010 Giants showed what it took to win in the postseason with pretty much just a pitching staff. They had their hitters, Buster Posey, Aubrey Huff, Freddie Sanchez, but everybody has some offense. You know, the real story of that team was Lincecum, Kane, Bumgarner, Sanchez. To an extent, Barry Zito was a part of that success. And then they had the lights out back of the bullpen. Yeah. Obviously. In any case, the reason they coined torture as their like catchphrase, watching Giants baseball is it's such torture, was because they had such a terrible offense. And that's the difference between being told you have a terrible offense and being told, oh, you have a scrappy offense. It's because they came back to win late in games. And that became their whole thing, which, you know, isn't super uncommon. But, it, you know, that year it was the Giants. By the way, does this sound familiar to any Phillies teams you may have encountered recently? Teams that wait until one out left in the ninth inning to, like, do the thing they're going to do to win the game? Kind of a thing this team's starting to be known for in 2026. But they're not going to be called scrappy anytime soon because there's legit superstars on this team who just need to decide to hit more. So I don't. You're not wrong, John. It can be enough. Clearly, as a team like the Giants, any of the even your Giants teams really can show you that like a pitching first team can win the World Series. But winning with a strong pitching staff still takes offense, and you've got to get it from somewhere you're not expecting. So if we want to go as far as to bring up the other thing from 2010 that led to the Giants' success, which was Cody Ross, a total rando jumping into the offense and being like, look how good I am and I can hit and I'm a contributor too. So that kind of means I looked at the stats really, really briefly and like comparatively. That kind of means you need Brandon Marsh to go gonzo again, in addition to, you know, the regular offense you're getting from Schwarbers and Harpers and whatever they're able to generate. But again, that all just also relies on the staff to continue pitching as well as they have. You got to think of that as a guarantee, because if that goes away, then all of this goes away. But again, right, it doesn't need to be that way if you just hit the ball, because we know you can do that too. And that's why this team is a little different from the 2010 Giants, because they have the potential, I think, for a much greater output of offense than that team was.
They do.
Aubrey Huff led that team in home runs with 26 home runs. Kyle Schwarber probably had 26 home runs by the end of May. So, like, this is a more promising offensive team, which is why it's more infuriating, because they should, and, like, really should always have been better offensively than they've been since 2022. But they're just remarkably inconsistent, and that, at this point, has become its own pattern. So you got to be able to generate offense even when you are a pitching first team. That there is no scenario where the lineup is like off the hook here. And that's what, you know, sometimes you see them shut down and you think that's what they think they're going to be able to get away with, and they're not.
I hate what an apt comparison that is to the 2010 Giants, because you're totally right. I hadn't even thought about that, but man, that's frustrating. I would love for, you know, the Cody Ross to be Brandon Marsh, but it could be Derek Hill. It could be.
That's,
you know,
what I was
thinking.
They've
got a lot
of
guys who, yeah, that can turn it on at any time. Like Edmundo Sosa had like a week where he was ultra hot. And, you know, that's kind of all you need. Just like you said, Justin, you just need one guy to go off and support everybody else. So, I mean, weirdly, as much as I hate the Giants, and I'm pretty sure the Giants fans said, oh, it's all like terrible when we watch games because they want to feel like they're special little people for their stupid little team.
This is why I didn't want to bring this up, because
yeah,
I
know you ripped open your scab, Justin. I'm not kidding, man.
I'm sorry. I'm like Hulk. My secret is that I'm always angry about that stuff. There's
right.
never a moment when I'm not.
Nope. Nope. We're always hulking but out about those 2010 Giants. Yeah, go ahead.
You know, that comparison makes me feel better, because you're right. There is, they can do it. We've watched it. We've hated it. But it's because that wasn't our team doing it.
Well, I want to dive into the offense and the bullpen a little bit more coming up here. But first, let us focus on the story for the Phillies of this series. And that is, of course, is the starting pitching. They got four phenomenal performances from each of their starting pitchers in this series. Christopher Sanchez had the worst outing of the bunch on Friday, and it was six innings, three earned runs, five hits, three walks, five strikeouts, and all that damage came in one inning. Some poor defense helped that along a little bit, although I still think probably all three runs would have come home based off of what happened after. But he pitched okay, kept them in the game. It was 3-2 when he left. On Saturday, Zach Wheeler finally looking like the Zach Wheeler we've all come to know. Some just absolutely outstanding pitches. His fastball, he's pinpointing that thing again with incredible velocity and movement. It looked like he was fully back. Six innings, three hits, one run, two walks, and nine strikeouts for Wheeler. That is a huge sigh of relief. Huge sigh of relief for this team. And then Aaron Nola. What has gotten into Aaron Nola? Seven innings, four hits, one run, one walk, five strikeouts. He has figured some things out as well that we can detail in a few minutes. And then, of course, the coup de grace was Jesus Luzardo with his first career shutout. Gave up just two hits, no runs, one walk, 12 strikeouts. OptiStats noted that for the Phillies so far this year, Christopher Sanchez has a .762 winning percentage and is averaging 10.27 strikeouts per nine. Luzardo's winning percentage is 737 with 11.13 strikeouts per nine. Wheeler has a 706 winning percentage and 10.76 strikeouts per nine. Never in major league history have three teammates each finished with a winning percentage of 700 or better and 10 strikeouts or more in the same season. Never. It's never happened before, which is kind of rarefied air. Just unbelievable stuff. And as far as Jesus Luzardo's game on Sunday is concerned, it was the 20th complete game shutout with at least 10 strikeouts and two hits or less in Phillies history. The last was Zach Wheeler in August of 2021. Ooh. Others this century, Nola, Hamels in 15, his no-hitter, Halliday's 2010 perfect game, and Kevin Millwood's 2003 no-hitter. And Jesus Luzardo tied for the second best game by a pitcher this season in terms of game score. Jacob Mizorowski had a 100 against the Phillies back in June when he struck out 15 and walked no one in a complete game one-hit shutout. And then Dylan Cease and Jesus Luzardo each had a game score of 94. 94, the second best game score in baseball this year. So, I mean, if you're going to feel good about something, and yes, I will own up to the fact that having great starting pitching, the Dodgers were a testament to this last year, gives you a legitimate chance. I do agree with Buster Olney and what he's hearing. I agree. I believe that there are teams that don't want to face the Phillies in the playoffs because they know that for six or seven innings, they're going to have a really, really hard time putting runs on the board. The concern, of course, is after that, that those middle 3 to 6 outs between when the starter goes out and when Joan Duran is able to come into the game. That's the bridge to gap. But for those 6 and 7 innings when a Philly starter is on the mound, this is it's the best trio in baseball. And now with Nola and Andrew Painter both pitching really well, it's kind of relentless at the moment. If this team gives them even just a little bit of consistent offense and the bullpen can have one or two guys figure it out, it's very, very, very scary. And so I just, they really came to play in this Atlanta series. And it's the numbers are eye popping right now with this group. They're all pitching great baseball.
They're just a lot of fun to watch. And that's, as a fan, that's what I look for. Like everyone likes good numbers and big strikeouts. But for me, just watching it happen and getting to see the pitching kind of overall be what we hoped it would be this year. I mean, you know, sort of like the best case scenario of what we had been thinking and hoping has played out, you know, a couple of different times this season. And this is the time that you want it to come together. Mm-hmm. You know, the starting pitching is so good. We should spend more time talking about the bullpen and how.
Oh, it's on the show sheet.
Really annoying there. Justin, you don't want to do that? No.
Did you not take a look at that 5-page show sheet we got? Good Lord. Like I'm at homework again. Anyway.
We got a show sheet?
It was a series split, but if you're looking for pluses, yeah, obviously the starting pitching was a huge plus. And, you know, everything about casting this as a playoff preview and everything, I mean, sure, maybe, fine, but obviously, teams are going to address these games differently in postseason. The only preview about it is that these are two teams that could face each other in an October situation. And that being the case, I mean, you know, again, who knows what the situation is at that point? It's at least good to be able to say that, like, the thing that's supposed to be strongest about this team is firing on all cylinders. This team may not have had a stronger, full-on 1-5 rotation than it has right now.
I agree with that.
And it's September 7th. So Wheeler's, you know, not as Wheeler-y, but getting there. I think that's fine. At this point in time, I said on Friday, I'm glad it's Jesus Luzardo in game 4. Makes you feel like you got your stopper going. And at different points, Wheeler's been the stopper. Sanchez has been the stopper. Having multiple guys who are capable of that is a huge strength. And being able to point to the calendar and say, like, look, even if they drop the first 3 games of this series and everybody's ticked off and having a miserable weekend, you know Lizardo's going to come out. And right now, he's got stuff that can shut down a lineup and salvage that series for you. And it's exactly what he did in a way that was so much more necessary than I thought it was going to be when I made that statement. But he authored that victory 99% himself, the other 1% being the baseball Kyle Schwarber put on the moon for him. And that was all it took. So that was great. And, you know, it's important to see. Other than that, you can just be glad that it's not the postseason. Be glad that you're playing the Braves 7 times in a row and you're not losing games because the offense can't score enough or the bullpen blows it. Know that you're just seeing further diagnoses of issues that could be problems later and that theoretically you could either address or just like have guys start to show improvement between now and when the postseason actually gets here. Like you still have the gift of time a bit on your side. So some of the stuff about this team that only works itself out after enough at bats or enough innings pitched still has time to get worked out enough for postseason baseball. Cause again, starting pitching is some of the best in baseball, if not the best in baseball, crafted specifically for a postseason run and everything. But all that does is give you a chance. Every time, it gives you a chance. That's what makes the Phillies a better team than a lot of other teams, but it doesn't make them the best team because those other parts don't always come through and have been so inconsistent all throughout the year, except the bullpen that hasn't been inconsistent. That's just been bad lately. So that's kind of your issue. You're going to have a shot to win every game. Okay, hitters, what do you want to do with that? Because you're going to get it almost every time.
Yeah, and for me, I mean, I don't look at... I thought the biggest issue that this team had this weekend was the bullpen more than the offense, although the offense was absolutely did not perform as well as we would have hoped them to. And I've got some numbers we'll run down here in just a second. But the Phillies should have won 3 out of 4. The game on Sunday, they had in the bag. It was 4-1 in the eighth inning. You just needed to get 5-6 more outs to get this one home. And it just, all the momentum was on their side. And look, I'll tip my cap to Ronald Acuña Jr., who's coming, except for Monday, was on some kind of heater in this series. 7-for-12 going into the game on Monday with a couple of home runs. And it really just hits in some monster spots. And the way he was playing off the crowd. And what did you guys think of him coming out for the curtain call, by the way? I thought it was hilarious. I couldn't believe people were like throwing his head, you know, trying to be. It's like, are you kidding me? Like, if Bryce Harper did that, we would be. I mean, he did it to Orlando Arcia. I mean, he Harpered the Phillies. It was hilarious. And like, if you hit a home run in that spot after getting cascaded with booze for the better part of 3 days, you absolutely come out of the dugout and take a curtain call, man. You do that thing.
I mean, you know, I'm trying to think of what's the acceptable word to use here. Like, you know, not a fan of you, man, but in like a more profane way, like for sure. But at the same time, you can, you know, this is why Ronald Acuña Jr. rocks. Like, this is why he's awesome, because he's the kind of guy that like, oh, well, if one of our players did it, we'd think it was great. Of course. But that's, you know, that's not the case, John. It was not one of our players.
No,
it was the guy we wanted more than anything to get out and not succeed in that situation. And then he did. So
about it. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying like I was like, oh, I didn't admire it in the moment. I'm just saying like I appreciate what was happening there from an intellectual standpoint.
Of course. And, you know, nobody, including me, was enjoying that or standing there and going, oh, Ronald Acuña Jr. rocks when he did that. It is... no. Pretty objectively hilarious in retrospect. It sucks that they gave that it had to be him. I said, you know, not to keep going back to Friday. I said on Friday, boy, you look at the numbers, it sure does seem like the last 2 weeks have been the 2 weeks Ronald Acuña Jr. has been gearing up to be Ronald Acuña Jr. again, almost like it's specifically for this series. And then, yeah, he was just a horrible monster to have to face the entire series. And again, you know, look, you can call him out all you want, like Wheeler did. You're going to pay for it. Like, this isn't Orlando Arcia or Travis d'Arno. This is a real baseball player. As Liz and I discussed, Acuña was only just, you know, starting to get hot again. Like, and the kind of player he is, he's gonna make you wear that too. So while I respect the risk of being like, hey, let's call this guy out, let's make a news cycle item out of this, let's compare him to how Kyle Schwarber runs the bases and get dangerously close to being Team USA in the WBC and Cal Raleigh ourselves straight out of like being able to play well ever again. But fine, you can do that, but Ronald Acuña Jr. is probably going to make you pay for it. And the worst part is he's going to have a great time making you pay for it. So there's a reason he is an incredibly satisfying out, and it's because he's an incredibly unsatisfying person to lose to. And that's exactly what he was.
There aren't a lot of baseball players that do that, that can do that, that warrant the type of response that we give him. And in baseball today, I think that guy, like right now, it's definitely Ronald Acuña. Like, you just did not, the thing I wanted least was for him to get hot. And of course, here he is. And he's just going to be terrorizing the Phillies because they play them again in less than a week, don't they? They play the Braves again pretty soon.
Yeah, next weekend.
And that will be deeply.
Next weekend.
That will be deeply unpleasant. Because Acuña will presumably take that through this coming week and in the end make us pay once again. I would like to hope that this time it won't happen and that everyone could just close their mouths and do their jobs until after the series is over.
You know why he got hot? Because you didn't want him to. And he's That's sticking right. it to you, too.
Just, well, not just also me, not throwing but all him, of you out there listening.
Also, not throwing him seven straight fastballs, one right after also the other in the same location would help to change things.
Also yeah.
We could have helped ourselves a little bit in that situation, I think. Caleb Cotham admitted after ahead of the game on Monday that it was his decision to call fastball after fastball after, and I know it's 100 miles an hour, but Ooh. Ronald Acuña Jr. will catch up to that thing eventually.
Like he hasn't seen 100 miles per right. hour a lot right. before.
It's,
like
it's,
guys
it's
throw
the
in their best
95
stuff
now.
Because he's one of the best out there. Exactly.
Right. So, I mean, yeah, it was that was kind of silly not to mix a sweeper in there at some point. But moving on from the rotation, we do have to talk about the bullpen because this is the thing that is the most worrisome about this team right now. I am most worried about the bullpen. I'm not as worried about the offense as I am about the relief situation because I don't see a whole lot of answers there. And as Scott Lauber smartly wrote this weekend, it's outs 20 through 24. Really, like you've just got to navigate outs like 19 to 20 to 24. Like those outs in this where the Phillies have in the playoffs fallen apart. And it happened on Sunday when they had a 4-1 lead. They had 21 outs in their pocket before Alex McFarland gave up a single, double, and a 3-run home run. On Friday, they weren't ahead, but they trailed by just a run. They were still in the game in the eighth inning when Kirkering gave up the 2-run home run to Ronald Acuña Jr. to put the game away. And in the playoffs, it's where the problems have come up. Game one of the NLDS last year, when Matt Strom gives up the 3-run home run to Teoscar Hernandez. They had logged 21 outs. Scott Lauber wrote about this in the Inquirer. That's where I'm getting this info, and he's right. Game one of the 24 NLDS. They had a 1-0 lead starting the eighth, 21 outs in their pocket before Jeff Hoffman and Matt Strom gave up 5 runs. Game three of the 2023 NLCS in Arizona. Kirkering blew a 1-0 lead with 18 outs recorded. Game four, the following night, Craig Kimbrell blows a 5-3 lead with 22 outs recorded in the eighth inning. And that doesn't even count the Francisco Lindor Grand Slam off Estevez in 2024. The bases loaded walk by Joan Duran in the seventh inning in game four against the Dodgers last year. Like this is just... This is the issue. This is the big issue with this Phillies team. And Don Mattingly is trying a whole bunch of different stuff now. I think that's what these last few weeks are going to be about. He's trying Kirkering in some high leverage areas. And I think we saw Don Mattingly say this weekend after that home run, we need to rethink the way we're using Orion Kirkering. I don't think you're going to see him in a situation like that again for a long while. And that's the right decision. So you move Alex McFarland, who has been lights out since being called up and has terrific stuff. And he's the one who got bombed on Sunday. So, I mean, Jonathan Bolin has given up home runs in 3 straight appearances. Just they're solo home runs, but still it's disconcerting that this guy who was unhittable is now giving up home runs left and right. Alvarado's looked better the last couple of outings, really looked good this weekend against the Braves, but no, there's no trust there yet with Jose Alvarado. Brooks Raley hasn't been the guy that you were thinking was going to maybe lock things down against lefty. So there's just a whole lot of uncertainty there in the bullpen, and this is my big concern, is that you're going to get a starting pitcher to give you 7 phenomenal innings, but man, that eighth inning, or he's going to give you 6 1/3 innings, but man, that reliever's not going to get you out of that seventh inning without giving something up, you know? And there's nothing to do about it. At this point, there's nothing you can do. There's no player you can get. There's no one you can call up. There's no one you can bring into the bullpen to fix it or to solve it. It's just... You're living on hope at this point, Liz. I mean, that's to me the most, you know, not frightening thing, but disconcerting thing is there's no answers to it. It's you just hope it resolves itself.
Yeah. And hoping it's going to resolve itself is all we as fans can do because we just have to watch those stupid games and bite our nails. And I genuinely hope that someone, whether it's Mattingly or anyone else on the staff, figures out how to place these guys. And I think focusing on a set roster of I'm going to go to these guys and these guys and these guys, I think that can sometimes set you up for failure because there's some inflexibility about it. And I don't I don't trust Mattingly to recognize those moments when he needs to be flexible outside of, you know, the established pattern that he's set. And at the same time, I don't necessarily trust him to figure out any of this on the fly or look at numbers before they go out there and be like, all right, I think this is a good idea. Like, I think the issue, I don't trust the bullpen, but I trust Don Mattingly even less because I just haven't seen him prove that he knows how to put these guys out there. And it's not always his fault. You know, he puts Kirkering in a spot and he can screw up. You know, McFarland, he said it was like one bad pitch and that was it. And you can't bank on that, but it feels real bad that it seems to happen a lot. You know, Jonathan Bolin giving up 3 home runs in three straight appearances is really bad. Like, I know that Rob Thompson used to take guys who'd had a bad outing and send them right back out. And I thought that was a pretty decent strategy sometimes because he would show them like, no, I haven't lost faith in you. You're still part of this team, even though you screwed up. We're going to give you a chance to do it again and show you nothing has changed with us because we don't believe anything has changed with you. You're going to go out tonight and you're going to have a great performance. But I don't know if that was the right decision with Jonathan Bolin, especially after appearance 2 when he gave up a home run. And
He didn't bring in Jonathan Bolin on Sunday specifically because they said they've noticed a downturn in his stuff when he pitches on back-to-back days. So it's nice of them to notice that now. Here's the thing. I was all for McFarland getting that shot on Sunday. Mm-hmm. I thought that was the right decision. And Justin, I wouldn't have gone to anyone else in that spot. But it says something that the veterans that you have on the team, that you don't have a better option, that you're saying, okay, let's give the rookie who's had 11 appearances and was in AA to start the season, you know, let's give him this chance to lock this game down. I mean, better now to learn, got to start learning who you can trust. And that's what these last 3 weeks are all about. Figuring out your order of trust. What does your trust tree look like? Who's on which branch right now?
Very close to no trust in this bullpen. You know, it went through phases over the summer. Duran really hasn't wavered too much, even though, again, he was also responsible for some of the damage this weekend as well. But nobody wants to think about that, including me. Bolin was obviously trustworthy for a while, less so now. You know, everybody else, you know, there was some excitement about McFarland there for a minute when he looked like he was kind of like, he had a couple of performances in a row or appearances in a row that were promising. But yeah, for the most part, it's not great. I mean, Brooks Raley, he's a lefty you can trust, I think, a little more than I do. Yeah. He had a terrible debut, but he's put up a lot of zeros since then. So like, that's good. But overall, yeah, I mean, it's like you said, it's about more of a statement as to like this being an issue at all. But the response there is simply like, yeah, well, you know, they got a crappy bullpen. You got a deal here. Like, that's, you got to just hope that, like I was talking about, time between now and the postseason, time that like Orion Kirkering strings together a couple of solid looking appearances. And then you're like, okay, I don't feel quite as bad about him coming in because there's not really a hero to go to at this point. I know that 2010 Giants comparison I made that we all loved, it comes with this caveat in that that team had the great starting rotation, had the great closer. They also had Santiago Casilla pitch in the seventh inning almost every day. He had a 1.42 ERA all season long through the regular season pitching in the seventh inning. He pitched in other innings, but he saw the seventh inning the most. And then the eighth inning belonged to Sergio Romo, who had a 1.47 ERA all year long through pitching in that spot. Phillies don't have that guy. Those two guys combined for the seventh and eighth inning, again, they pitched in other innings, but for the most part, if you're talking about the seventh or eighth inning, you're mostly talking about those guys. They combined to allow 2 home runs all regular season long.
Wow.
The 2 of them. The Phillies don't have that guy. The Phillies don't have close to that guy. So this is a bullpen that's very swiftly entering the state of like survival mode, where this bullpen's coming into a game and you're just thinking, 3 outs is not that many outs. Like, you can get outs and then we can all breathe again and then we can go back to see like what's going to happen next. But this bullpen's a problem and it's too late to fix it. So you got to just hope that, and by fix it, I mean swap new guys in there. So you got to just hope that the people who are out there can start to look a little bit more promising heading into the postseason, so you can get the ball in Duran's hand and hopefully close out a tight game. Because otherwise, I mean, again, what's the option? There's teams that have been successful here, and they've all had a piece you didn't have.
Yeah, and Liz, I think one of the things that will happen in October is we'll see Andrew Painter probably move to the bullpen. And his issues in the first inning, he's been better in the first inning his last couple of outings, and so maybe that's kind of going to be something that he can move past, they can help figure out. But he's obviously not going to, I don't think he's going to make any starts in the playoffs. It's very rare that you need a number four starter, let alone your fifth starter. And his stuff plays up better in the bullpen than Aaron Nola's would. You know, and I guess there's still, you know, a guy like Gage Wood is still down there. But I mean, it's September 7th. We're not doing that now. That's too late in the season to kind of fool around with Gage Wood stuff. And even if I think, you know, you could put him on a postseason roster because he's on the 40-man roster. But you're just not doing that at this point. So it's really probably you're kind of hoping Andrew Painter can provide another right-handed option in the bullpen in October. And I don't know if they would want to save him as like a Nola piggyback in the playoffs, or if they would use him in a high leverage spot. It's something he's never been asked to do, whether it's in the minors or in the majors, have to learn how to get ramped up for a high leverage spot in the bullpen. But we all know his stuff is what it is, Liz. I mean, I think they have to at least be considering using him in that kind of a role, especially if Bolin and McFarlane and Kirkering continue to be inconsistent here over these last few weeks.
I think the Phillies are absolutely considering it, because they don't necessarily need him for the rotation. So, and they want to use him because he's been good. Now, if they don't try him in a high leverage situation before we get to the playoffs, that is a huge mistake. They have to take the last week and a half of the season and try this out and put him out there and see if it works. Because if they're just going to go cold, that's a terrible idea. And I don't think they would do that. But until it happens, I'm left with the question, will they do that? Because you can put a lot on Andrew Painter. He, you know, he's brought himself back up. He's kept his confidence up, and he hasn't let anything get him down really this season. But expecting him to enter a game as a relief pitcher for the first time in the playoffs, high leverage or no, that is uncontrollable adrenaline. It's rampant. It's not going to be, I don't think it'll be a great outing. And I think they would do him a disservice by doing that to him. So I'm hoping that they try that out, because they don't have a lot of other ideas. I'm not saying that it's a bad idea. I think I like it, but they also just don't have anything else to do. You're right. They're not going to bring up, and they shouldn't, and pretty much can't bring up Gage Wood at this point, because that's just unfair to him as a player. And so the guys on the team. You have to make it work with who you have. And that's the whole season is about that, in the way. You know, it's a marathon that leads into a sprint. And if you don't figure out what you have until you get to the sprint, you've got a problem.
Any more thoughts on the bullpen? Before we wrap up, I want to move on to the offense, but anything to close the loop on the bullpen, Justin?
Just that, you go back and forth. On the one hand, getting somebody new in there who has gone from bad to absent to encouraging to good to flat out dominant sounds like a great idea. But then the other side of that coin is like, this is a rookie kid, and you're kind of asking him to fix your bullpen and come in a high leverage spot in the playoffs. Ironically, the time that Orion Kirkering, when he debuted, that's exactly what he did, and he came through for them. But it comes with those caveats, but at the same time, you're out of options, and he'll definitely, that's the role he's going to get, is he's going to be put out there, and they'll use him how they see fit, and it'll be better to see him come in than any of these guys we've watched blow a game or blow a lead in the past couple of weeks. But nothing's promised, and at the end of the day, he's just one guy. So I think the bullpen's still going to be something that you're going to have to just learn to survive in the postseason. Just to pivot perfectly, it'd be great if the offense could help out here too, because that would make that problem a lot less of a problem.
Well, this is where the professional broadcaster makes his segue, Justin, as you so helped deliver me in the lane there. Yeah, we're going to talk about the offense a little bit. It was fun for a while there, all the getting on base and the walking and the not striking out. It was a good time for a little bit there. The issue here this weekend against the Atlanta Braves was runners in scoring position. They had a lot of opportunities to score in this series. There were a couple of times where they had some runners in scoring position and hit rockets that were caught in the outfield. Ronald Acuna made an unbelievable catch in the game on Sunday? Yeah, I think it was Sunday, the game they lost, when they got up 2-0 early and they had the bases loaded. Maybe it was on Friday. It was on Friday that this game, Bryson Stott hit a rocket to right center field that Ronald Acuna made an insane catch. That should have been 5-0 at that point. And then there was another play later in the game where Alec Bohm is a runner on third with two outs and he hits a rocket into the hole that Kim makes a diving stab for and gets a force out at second base. I mean, you just can't do anything about those plays. But 3-for-28 with runners in scoring position in this series for the Phillies, a 107 batting average with runners in scoring position. And again, you'll all remember the stats we were throwing out there from the beginning of August through about August 23rd, before the West Coast road trip. The Phillies were first in on-base percentage. They were first in walk percentage. They were first in strikeout percentage, and they were first in runs. Shall we play this game? And you guys tell me where you think, since the Seattle series, since the start of the West Coast trip, so that's August 24th through today, where do you think the Phillies rank in on-base percentage right now? Position, like in terms of the 30 major league teams.
Why are you making us do this?
For funsies.
You mean like as part of the season long rankings?
Okay. No, I'm saying no. From August 24th until right now, during that stretch of time, like the last 2 weeks, where do the Phillies rank in terms of on-base percentage? So they were first from August 1st through the 23rd. Now let's look at these next few weeks. Where do they rank now, do you think?
Probably like their team stats have them typically, barring these like spikes in either direction, living around like 16th, 15th or 16th in a lot of these cumulative stats. But I have a feeling it might be even worse.
Liz, what do you think?
I'm going to say 20th.
It's 22nd. They are 22nd in on-base percentage since August 24th. They were also first in walk rate. Where do you think they are in walk rate right now?
Worse than what I said, for sure. Walk rate specifically. Okay. I think it's going to be, let's say 25th.
Is Harper still walking a ton?
Yes. Yeah, he's still walking a bunch. Schwarber's walked a bunch.
Maybe 11th?
It's in between you guys, 16th. 16th in baseball over the last, since the Seattle series in terms of walk rate. Strikeout rate, this number was surprising. I'll give you this number because it's much lower than I thought. Only 26. I mean, they have the fifth best, the fifth lowest strikeout rate.
Okay.
So it was 26th ranked from, I've got the spreadsheet open here. It was ranking from big number to little number. That's not the number you want for a strikeout rate. So fifth best strikeout rate in baseball. It felt like they were striking out a lot in this Atlanta series, but overall, since the Seattle series, they actually haven't been striking out. But in terms of total runs scored, remember they'd scored the most runs in baseball from the start of August through August 23rd. Where do you think they rank in terms of runs scored from August 24th through now?
I'll go back to 25.
Liz.
I don't think I can put them much higher than that. That's tough.
25 is the number
on
the dot.
Woo! Go, Justin.
So they have scored the sixth fewest runs in baseball after, and just the plate discipline that we'd seen, the walk rate that we'd seen team-wide from everybody. I think, it couldn't last. It didn't last. And pitchers adjust. Pitchers stopped throwing as many pitches out of the strike zone to the Phillies. They realized the Phillies weren't going to chase everything. And so now they're coming back over the plate and we're seeing the Phillies get on base. They're still getting on base a little bit in this series. Again, they got on base quite a bit. What will really help is if Luis Arraez picks up his numbers with runners in scoring position. He has come to the plate with more runners on base than any player in baseball since coming to the Phillies, and it's by a lot. And entering after Saturday's game, coming into Sunday, he was hitting 250 with runners in scoring position with the Phillies. So if he picks that up, it was like 370 with the Giants or coming into before the trade. If he can find somewhere in the middle there, I think this offense looks a lot different. I think he's the wild card in the playoffs for the Phillies offense this year. It's like they've never had a guy in the middle of the order like that. Right now, he's just not getting those hits in those big situations like he typically has. So, you know, you get a couple more hits a series from Luis Arraez and with these runners in scoring position, it could be a different series one way or the other, especially in a postseason where runs are so scarce. So, I don't know. Where are you, Justin, on the offense right now, the way things stand at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, it was about that time in a Phillies playing pretty well streak for somebody to point out, you know, they've actually been terrible for 3 weeks and you didn't notice.
Is that my voice you're doing? Is that me?
That's generally how I'm approaching
this. That was
this.
Me. He was is doing that, me, guys. Oh, my God.
Is that
God.
Not a pinpoint John Stonis? That's how I hear it in my head. Was that not? I feel like I nailed it. Yeah, oh my God, were they secretly terrible again? And now we can look back at a sample size and point out how bad they were? That's, okay, cool. Oh, how weird for this offense. Are you telling me that they were inconsistent in being one of the best offensive teams in baseball during a certain sample size? No, this was going to happen. If they were this hot at the end of September, they would have wavered going into October. They come and go. That's how this works. I have numbers for this. The Phillies' OPS with runners in scoring position is pretty locked in since 2022 at around 760 to 780. That's almost scripture at this point. Like that's mm-hmm. what their output's going to be there with runners in scoring position. Batting average, yeah, about 260 in the 260s generally is what you're looking at. These aren't going to be league worst numbers. They are going to be frustrating numbers, especially for a team whose expectations since 2022 have been pretty high. And in 2022 specifically, they were good, mediocre with runners in scoring position and only slightly worse in the postseason than they were in the regular season. But you have the last three times where their numbers are average at best with runners in scoring position. And then October gets here and everything drops at least 100 points. And part of that's because, yeah, the sample size in the postseason also gets smaller. So it's also more dramatic cumulatively. But it's been 2024 specifically, which you remember as a particularly enchanting postseason, where their team OPS with runners in scoring position dropped 253 points and they actually hit under 200 against the Mets with runners in scoring position. So this year, I come to you bearing a torch of hopefulness. Because if the season ended today, their batting average and OPS with runners in scoring position would be their highest in both categories of any of these years that I'm talking about. But the fact of the matter is this team can start being bad at any time with runners in scoring position. That's where you start seeing it happen.
Yeah.
I think when the offense just like isn't working as well, that's where you start to see the cracks show first, that they're just not getting the job done with guys on base. And, you know, that's just how it is. Sometimes they get a little better. Sometimes they get a little worse, and it all comes out the other end as like average to bad. So I hope they have a late July style hitters meeting and agree to stop swinging at pitches headed for their eyeballs or 2 feet out of the zone again, because that seemed like it was really helpful. And they're going to need that kind of like thoughts and notes in their heads going into the next part of the season, because we all knew it was going to wear off. It wore off and it's got to come back. Now, to your point, John, yeah, I do also do think that it's all but assured that Luis Arraez is going to improve his numbers, and that might be it. That might be all you need to really work things out in that regard, because he was about as automatic as you can get. So having a guy who's automatic be automatic again, which, yes, I realize defeats the purpose of the phrase automatic. Yeah, that's going to do a lot for this offense with runners in scoring position. again, inconsistent doesn't mean bad all the time. It means bad some of the time after they've been good some of the time. And yeah, they got to get back to being good at it because sometimes they are. And that's honestly the best you get in mid-September. That's the best you're going to get as far as the forecast goes. At least they're a team that has not, at least they're not a team that has never been good with runners in scoring position in 2026.
Yeah, I mean, they can hang their hat on that, Liz, and maybe just it's this certain subset of pitching they face. Maybe they get back to it. But it's clear that whatever it is that had come across them when Luis Arraez arrived is worn off a little bit, at least in terms of the walk rate. But they're still not striking out as much, which I think is encouraging. And if you're putting the ball in play, you know, you're generally giving yourself a better chance than if you're striking out all the time. And I don't know.
Just to add real quick to what you're saying, John, the Phillies' hard hit rate against the Braves was 37.2% of the balls they hit were what Fangraphs considers a hard hit ball. And the Braves had under 30%. So they out-hit the Braves as far as hard hit balls goes. To your point about like hard outs being kind of got glossed over here, they also had a higher fly ball rate and a lower ground ball rate than the Braves did through these four games too. So these are also peripheral positives.
Yeah, I think the Phillies offense outperformed the Braves offense in this series. And without Ronald Acuna Jr. going on an unbelievable hot streak, you know, but you could say the same thing about Schwarber, though. Three home runs in his last three games. I mean, they kind of matched Ronald Acuna there. And that's what the Phillies have traditionally done, Liz, in the playoffs is get those big home runs. Even in 22, almost all of the big offensive moments were home run moments during that playoff run. And that's typically how this team scores in the playoffs. It's good to have that. And you'll know when this Phillies team is really dangerous when they can still hit those home runs, but also mix in some of the other stuff with runners in scoring position. And we've just never seen that. I don't know that we ever will, but that's what we're all dying to see. It's like, yes, Schwarber, continue to hit the home runs, you know, and get those bombs, and Harper, you too, and, you know, the occasional homer from someone else. But yes, when you've got second and third, when you got a runner on second and nobody else, God, that guy's got to get home. That guy's got to get home somehow, some way. And they're doing that a little bit better with Arraez here, but that's what was most frustrating about the offense in this series. They left a lot of chances, a lot of meat on the bone in this series.
That's what infuriated me the most. Like, none of these runners and scorer position numbers are all that shocking to me. Though I think that makes sense too. Like, and the balls that they hit directly at fielders, really hard, directly at fielders to the point where they didn't even have to move. I'm like, did you do that on purpose? How does that keep happening? guess they are doing that on purpose. Now I forgot what I was saying, but it doesn't really matter. I can only hope that Arraez will continue to get better. I really wish I knew what it was that makes good hitters, when they come to Philadelphia, maybe not fail, but like take a little bit of a dip. You know, there are many examples in my head of this happening. I don't feel like mentioning any of them. But I know calling it a thing just means we're making it a thing, but it feels like it's a thing. Am I wrong?
No, I mean, I think
it's a thing.
I think it's happened, but I mean, I also look at Harrison Bader last year too, and he had the best 2 months of his life with the Phillies. Now his problem was he got hurt at exactly the wrong time. And that also seems like a Phillies thing, but you know, I think bad luck happens to lots of teams, you know,
yes,
and,
it does.
It's, you know, and the Phillies have, in addition to all of the faults that this team has, they've also suffered some bad luck in these postseasons. Like, it's just Chaz McCormick going up against the wall in Game 5 of the World Series. You know, Schwarber hitting that rocket at Trey Mancini at first base. That probably is a double most of the other times. You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of luck that goes into performing well in October. The Phillies have not had any luck on their side in these last few years either.
I think the more common pattern recently has been the Phillies think they're going to get more out of a guy who hasn't been performing than he has been able to give. And then, whoops, no, he's not capable of that. So it's more like low-level guy stays low-level rather than high-level guy comes here and wilts.
that's yeah, Kepler, Josh Harrison, all those guys. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Any other things from this Atlanta series that we want to touch on, guys?
I mean, ultimately, yeah, I wish they had just swept them. I'm not saying I'm happy about the outcome at all. It's just more that, like, if you're looking for, like, who proved they were better, I don't know there's a clear answer to that question. And yeah. I think maybe one thing you can conclude is that winning the NL East is now pretty tough, like, especially if you're looking at Phillies Braves matchups being the defining factor there. Yeah, you're gonna have to sweep them in Atlanta now, and I don't think that's gonna happen. So, you know, that might be the conclusion to draw from this. But ultimately, if these two teams meet in the postseason, I mean, you know, I don't want to play any postseason games on the road, but at the same time, I'm not specifically afraid of the Atlanta Braves in a postseason situation. I think a lot of these teams, including the Dodgers, have strengths and weaknesses that have been on display for a couple of weeks now, and everybody's got something to exploit. The Phillies are one of those teams, but they're just as able to exploit the other teams as much as other teams can exploit them. And we saw that this weekend too. So like I said, every result you want to see evidence for, they kind of gave you that. The Phillies are playing at a high level and they're still winning games, and they've only lost that one series, in recent memory. So, like, they are still playing at a high level, and they're a team that is going to be playing in October. That's kind of, like, the best you can hope for right now. Because even a team that was setting the world on fire and swept the Braves in four games could just as easily get swept out of the playoffs a month from now.
And I'll say this, too. I no longer care about playing these games at home or not. I'm not so sure it's not better these guys don't play on the road. They have a better road record right now in baseball and this season than they do at home. It's not by much, but they're 10 games over 500 at home and only 9 games over 500. 10 games over 500 on the road, 9 games over 500 at home. They're 1-5 in their last 6 home postseason games. I'm not so sure these guys wouldn't be better served starting off in Chicago against the Cubs in a wild card series, or starting off in Atlanta taking on the Braves in a wild card series, where I think they play with more pressure on them in front of their home fans. And I think we've seen in baseball, home field advantage just doesn't mean all that much. It just doesn't. I think these guys play tight at home a lot of times, and especially as the games in October get, you know, the first time something goes wrong, there's just going to be that sense of dread in the place. So listen, if they finish, I want them to finish wild card one. And if they win the division, that's great. But I'm also not worried if they start on the road and they have to play a road wild card series. That might even be the best thing for them, to kind of come in as underdogs and not have to think like, you know, we should win this series. If they go in anything thinking we should win this, like we're the favorites, like we have no business not winning this series, then I think that puts them in panic mode when something doesn't go right.
Absolutely. The Phillies fans have been a blessing, but also quite a curse, because everyone remembers how it was in 22 when the crowd was loud and excited because this was the first time we'd seen them do any of this in many years. And then the next year, it was still pretty loud. And then 24, you could feel it drop off because people were starting to get concerned. When something goes wrong, the crowd goes quiet and they don't get loud again until something good happens, until someone does something good. And that's really, I think that's really it. Either the crowd has to be induced to be how they were in 22, or the Phillies have to get over it. The Phillies have to figure out a way to block it all out and not feel so tense. Like, the crowd isn't going to help them with things. The booze might hurt their ears.
Rhetoric.
But they should not.
You pelt them with rhetoric. I mean, that can be hurtful.
I guess
condescending
that is true.
Remarks.
That's
sure.
Right.
Yelled through a bullhorn pointed specifically at one player.
Or a beer cup.
Exactly. So I'm just saying that I'm agreeing with you. Home field advantage for the Phillies isn't what it was. And that is a fan thing. And I can't say I blame the fans for being a little hot and cold, because the Phillies themselves have been hot and cold in the playoffs. But it's hard to expect the Phillies to do well because of the crowd if the crowd isn't there and behind them. And so I think that's really the playoff problem with their games at home. And I don't know if there's a way to fix it, because they have to actually win. They have to actually win things so Phillies fans feel more confident.
Look, it's cool to be a team that wins all the time at home, but going into October, I kind of want to see what a team that wins equally in either environment does, because that makes you feel a little more bulletproof. Suddenly you're on the road, and even if you're not a bad road team, but you play that much better at home, that's all anybody's talking about. So while I still, on September 7th, I still don't want to play PCA at Wrigley. It's less of a concern right now to be on the road or at home or be a wild card team or a division winner. Like I said, get in and win. That's all this team. Want them thinking about what they are or who they are. Yeah. We're the underdog. We're the blah, blah, blah. No, you're a team playing a ball game. Let's win it. And that's all it's got to be.
Well, in between the next time these two teams face each other, which will be next weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, the Phillies in Atlanta, the Phillies will, for the rest of this week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, host the Houston Astros at Citizens Bank Park for a 3-game series. The Astros are playing slightly better baseball. They're 73-71 coming into Citizens Bank Park. But the Phillies will have Andrew Painter, Christopher Sanchez, and Zach Wheeler lined up for that 3-game series. The Thursday game is a daytime game. The other two games are night games on Tuesday and Wednesday. So an improved Astros team coming to Citizens Bank Park. They have been playing a little bit better as of late before the Phillies have this rematch with the Braves down in Atlanta. All right, let's wrap up with some final thoughts as we are, well over an hour deep into this podcast. I hope y'all stuck with us all the way till the end there for final thoughts. Justin, any final thoughts for people?
Just that we are doing another episode of The Dirty Inning in September, coming up this week. That is about the time in 1890 that they swept four teams in a single month. It's coming off the stats you saw generated by the Phillies doing that this year. And they did it in 91 and they did it in 76. And then the only time before that was in 1890. So we, of course, chose to talk about the 1890 Phillies and how hot, hot, hot they got in July of 1890, as well as several other goings on in the city of Philadelphia at that time. Crime wave, summer crime wave,
our favorite thing
to talk about on that show. So
never heard you guys broach that subject on The Dirty Inning. It's really it's a rarity, but
some great crimes.
Some great, especially in the 1890s. I mean, that's a whole crime was different back
then.
Oh
yeah. Crime was very different. And yeah, we get into that a little bit on this show. So yeah, that's going to be a fun episode over at the Patreon at patreon.com/hittingseason.
There it is. Liz, final thoughts.
My final thought is, how did they really solve murders back then? Like, you could really just kill someone.
We discuss that a lot. You just go to another town and don't turn your head if someone yells your name, and then you have gotten away with the crime.
You just pick up another name and say, now I'm this person. How can you prove I'm not?
Great
thought. It's 1890.
Yes. Most
that's
of those stories end with someone getting on a train and the cops are like, ah, and that's it. That's the end of the murder investigation.
That's the end.
Yeah. You had to catch him in the act.
It's the only reason we got H.H. Holmes.
Final thought. I'm not going to do the whole rant I wrote out, because enough time has passed and enough moments have happened in this particular story. But everybody catch umpire Doug Eddings correcting hat angle of a young Cardinals pitcher making his major league debut the other day. The only reason to talk about it now is to say, oh, I have never seen two teams take an issue like that into the following night and continue protesting against it. I have never seen the league tell an umpire they were wrong before.
Yeah.
That was groundbreaking in those, but that was what my whole rant was about, was that like this whole moment was orchestrated by this guy who, by his own account, no one broke any rules. Like, he just wanted to be that guy, that kind of umpire for a moment. And it was such a naked one of those moments, just a totally transparent, this is about me moment. And you're like, there's no argument to be made here for the other side, other than this umpire was just wrong to do what he did. And somehow, against every odd in the world, Major League Baseball agreed. So I just wanted to point that out, that actually happened. That was insane.
Yeah.
That's my final thought.
Yeah, no, that was wild. And yeah, the most surprising thing and crazy thing was Major League Baseball said, you know what, you guys are right. Actually, the umpire went too far there. That really was incredible. All right, everybody, that's going to do it for this edition of Hittin' Season. We will be back, of course, midweek. I'll be back midweek. We'll talk a little bit about the Astros series. Then we'll have another Braves series to preview at the end of the week with Justin and Liz. So make sure you're sticking with us here all through the week as we take you through the pennant race here at the end of the season. This video roundtable podcast will be seen on the WHYY YouTube channel. So if you haven't subscribed to the WHYY YouTube channel, you should do that. You can get all the roundtable shows there. If you are an audio podcast person only, we are at Apple Podcasts. We are at Spotify. We're everywhere you can get your podcasts. And if you want to send us an email, let us know what you think about the show. You can do that, hittinseason@phillypen.com. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. We'll talk to you next time right here on Hittin' Season.